What is it about the character of Jesus Christ that makes him so compelling for the reader of the Gospels? I know I'm asking a big question there, but looking back over our series through Mark's Gospel, perhaps we could identify two particular aspects of the character of Christ which, when held together, make him so compelling. The first is his selflessness. The Jesus of Mark's Gospel is totally without pride. There's a meekness, a humility to this man which is completely unpretentious and which seems to break down all of those normal barriers between people, age and class and culture. And to the contrite heart, that selflessness of Christ makes him totally unintimidating. It's warm, it's reassuring, and the sinner, the humbled sinner, finds himself drawn towards him like a magnet. The second aspect, however, is his self-confidence. Because somehow, Jesus can be both extremely selfless and extremely self-certain. I mean, think about it. The Jesus that we meet in this gospel is an uncompromising prophet who pronounces doom upon his enemies and rebukes storms and fevers. And more than that, he claims to be the Son of Man. Time and time again, Jesus claims to be that great King of Heaven and King of Earth that we meet in Daniel chapter 7 on his way to the royal throne. And it's strange, isn't it? Because usually dogmatism is an unattractive character trait. It turns us off when we meet it in people. Yet somehow, Jesus is able to be more dogmatic than anybody we meet in our entire lives, and yet this time, we consider it a compelling virtue. So he's a selfless servant, and yet he's also this self-confident Son of Man. Last month, the comedian Russell Brand got baptized and claimed to have become a Christian. Now, whatever we would make of Brand's profession, and I would not want to be too skeptical about it, but whatever we may make of it, what at least is clear is this, that Russell Brand also finds the character of Jesus Christ irresistibly compelling. In a video on Twitter last week, Brand said this. He said, "I like the idea when I'm in prayer and in communion just alone, there is a figure available, wounded and coronated." And I would say that Brand's words there get to the heart of what we've just been saying. Wounded, the selfless servant who dies in our place, and coronated, the self-confident Son of Man on his road to the coronation. And actually, Jesus says that very much himself back in Mark's Gospel, back at Mark chapter 10, verse 45. Jesus says of himself, "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." In the very same sentence, Jesus calls himself the Son of Man, that great King of the universe, and he's a servant. He's one who comes not to be served, but to serve. And I think that verse back in Mark chapter 10 should shape how we interpret Jesus' death in Mark's Gospel. And that's then how we're going to read this passage before us this evening. Mark chapter 15, verses 21 to 32. As we read this passage, I want us to see those two things that I've just mentioned. I want us to see Jesus, the selfless servant, and I also want us to see Jesus, the self-confident Son of Man. And it's those two things then that will provide our two headings this evening. So firstly, Jesus, the selfless servant. Jesus, the selfless servant. Throughout Mark's Gospel, Jesus has shown a commitment to service that is so sacrificial, at times it appears almost debasing and undignified. This is the man who touches the unclean, the leper, the woman with the discharge of blood, the dead little girl. He does that for the sake of serving them. This is a man who ventures to the other side of a stormy lake to serve a dirty and deranged Gentile living in a tomb, surrounded by a herd of pigs, possessed by demons. This is the man who has no interest in flattering a rich young potential disciple, and instead welcomes poor little children into his arms. This is the man who has spent his last days at the house of a man called Simon the leper, and there allows a woman to pour perfume over his feet. And people have looked at all of that and have said, this is undignified. But Jesus is set on serving these people all the same. Time and again, Jesus has made a deliberate break from all expectations about what constitutes good manners, what is dignified, what is proper, what is honourable for a religious teacher. He sacrificed all of that for the sake of those whom he loves. For their sake, he has made himself this selfless servant. But of course, it's not until these last few chapters of Mark's Gospel that we see just how far his commitment to service and sacrifice will take Jesus. No, as Jesus told us back in Mark chapter 10, he has come to sacrifice his life. That is the undignified sacrifice we now behold in Mark chapter 15. Since chapter 14, we have seen Jesus descend deeper and deeper into that sacrifice. We have seen him pass through the humiliation and the mockery and the crown of thorns and the purple robe and the flogging and the spitting and the beating. And each time it's as if our servant bends lower and lower beneath us to serve us. But now you see he goes further still and he descends into the deepest recesses of this sacrifice. Jesus now approaches death itself. He makes his way into the very mouth of death itself. And what could be more servile? Yes, Jesus has already risked defiling himself, so to speak, for the sake of others. Defiling himself with death, that man living in the tombs, touching the dead body of Jairus' daughter. And for some, that was a sacrifice too far. But now he goes even further and he enters into death itself. And Mark, he pictures it very vividly for us in verse 22 of chapter 15. And they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. We can only speculate as to why it had that name. Perhaps it was the site of rotting bodies still nailed to their crosses. The frightening sight of exposed skulls still staring down from those old crosses. The Romans left the remains of those bodies on those crosses for weeks sometimes to allow the birds to slowly peck away at them, their skulls grinning down upon everyone who passed by. Well, Jesus makes his way to that place, to that cross, to die, to take his place amongst the skulls. And there Mark states it very coldly, very plainly, and they crucified him. Verse 24. It's as if it's just nothing more than this stark, brutal fact. They crucified him. And for ancient readers, that word alone was so filled with shame, you only had to say it, and it brought all of those horrible connotations to mind. And then that verse 24 goes on to tell us about the way in which they cast lots over Jesus' garments. There's something particularly callous about that, isn't there? You're shivering and naked on a cross, and there before you, your clothes that you were only wearing 5 minutes ago are now being divided up amongst these people. These little people are playing that game with their dice in front of you, rolling their dice, dividing up your clothes, and in that little act you see the complete irrelevance of your life to those people. Never again will I be putting those clothes back on. As far as these people are concerned, I'm dead already. And then the mockery worsens. The scribes mock him, we're told. The passers-by mock him. Even the two crucified criminals mock him. I mean, imagine that. These criminals who themselves are humiliated and nailed to crosses. And now even they decide to deride Jesus. That's how they use their final breaths, mocking their fellow sufferer. making his death even more miserable than theirs. And so Jesus then, he's nailed into this position of absolute humiliation, literally. He can't bring his hands to his ears and block out the sound of the laughter and the derision, even if he wanted to. So what's going on here in this scene then? What are we witnessing? Well, as I say, this is Jesus' act of service, as he describes it in chapter 10. And in what way does this constitute an act of service? Well, because in his own words, this is him giving his life as a ransom for many. In other words, this horrible death is him paying for your salvation. This is him giving up his life, putting it down as a payment for your life. This is him slaving away in hell, we could say, for your sake. This is him resigning himself to the burdens and the blows of hell that you deserve to pay for your release. And he doesn't have to do it. But he does it. And he does it to redeem you. In that same video on Twitter last week, Russell Brand said this. He said, "I love the simplicity of the idea of God come to earth as a man to experience what it is to be human and to sacrifice himself, because that's the only sacrifice that could bring us home, that could give us the opportunity for redemption." Well, perhaps we wouldn't express it quite in those words ourselves, but it's encouraging, isn't it, that a man like Russell Brand could even find himself speaking so solemnly of Christ's death. And Brand is right insofar as he calls Christ's death a sacrifice. It is a sacrifice. That's what we're witnessing here. He saved others. He cannot save himself, the scribes say. No, the truth is that he does not save himself, precisely that he might save others. Because this is a sacrifice for them. This is how he serves us. And I just want us to notice just a couple of things here in this passage, just to the extent to which Jesus throws himself into this sacrifice for us. The extent to which he is actively and consciously serving us in all of this. Because it is there. And I think it's there, firstly, in the fact that we just don't see any resistance in Jesus to what's going on. Crucifixion is not inescapable for the Son of God. When those scribes say he cannot save himself in verse 31... we know that they're wrong. They're badly wrong. Of course Jesus can save himself. And that's what makes those words sting. But the point is that he doesn't. He complies with this torture. He actively resigns himself to it. He refuses to save himself. He refuses to curse his persecutors. He refuses to beg for their mercy. Notice what else he refuses in verse 23. He refuses to drink the wine mixed with myrrh. It says he did not take it. It's interesting, in Proverbs chapter 31, verses 6 and 7, talk about strong drink being given to those who are in pain. It says, "Give strong drink to the one who is perishing, and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more." So the idea seems to be that this wine, it's acting like a narcotic. It's something to dull the pain, something to weaken the senses, something which makes the struggle against death a little bit easier, just a little bit easier. And Jesus refuses it. He refuses the narcotic. And of course, it's not that Jesus is against painkillers or anything like that. It's that he doesn't have any interest in dulling and numbing this pain. This seems to be his way of fully throwing himself into this sacrifice. Death is staring him in the face, and the temptation is for Jesus to drink that wine and to look away and try to forget about that death. But the point is, he wants to be alert. He doesn't want to numb himself. He wants to be able to look death right back in the eyes and be able to give death full reign over him. At Wynne Layton, we've been going through the book of Romans. We looked last week at Romans chapter 6. And Romans chapter 6 says that when Jesus died, death no longer had dominion over him. But the implication seems to be that until that point, through the dying process, death did have dominion over him. Death tortured him. The devil had fun with him. The Lord willed to crush him. Death reigned over him up until the point when he actually died. And the point of this passage is that Jesus makes himself feel that. He looks death in the face with wide eyes and says to it, "Do your worst over me." He wants every nerve in his body to be alert, ready to soak up the agony that death has to offer. He's opening himself up to it, allowing it to trample over him. And it's because this is a servant actively and consciously paying our ransom. And when we see him on that cross, we see him actively, selflessly serving us. Indeed, of all the acts of service that Christ performs in this book, this is the most debasing, the most painful, the most humiliating, the most horrifying that you can possibly conceive of. And in response to it, we should melt down and run into his arms. So this is our selfless servant. Before I move on to my next point, I do want to observe something interesting in this passage. It's there in verse 21. "And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross." The Gospel of Mark has an awful lot to say about Christian discipleship. As we've said before, chapters 8 to 10 are almost devoted to that theme. As Jesus walks along that road to Jerusalem with his disciples, he is teaching them about what discipleship is like. And in particular, it's worth remembering how he describes this life of Christian discipleship right back at the beginning of those chapters. In chapter 8, verse 34, he says there, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." And of course, I mention that verse because surely in Mark chapter 15, we now have a striking image, a striking picture of discipleship in the person of Simon of Cyrene. Remember how back in chapter 10, James and John had asked Jesus to be able to sit beside him in his glory, to be on his right hand and on his left hand. That's what they think being a disciple of Jesus is all about, sharing in that moment of glory. Well, James and John are conspicuously absent from Mark chapter 15, and their coveted positions on the right and the left of Jesus have been taken by others, haven't they? It's those two thieves who are now flanking Jesus, not James and John. But we do have a disciple present in this passage, or at least a picture of a disciple, and it's Simon of Cyrene, isn't it? And what's he doing? He's literally carrying his heavy cross. He's literally taking up that cross, and he's literally following Jesus along that road. It's a striking picture of this great theme that's been building in Mark's gospel. And I think it's interesting, by naming Simon of Cyrene, by identifying him, what's Mark doing? Well, it's almost as if he's dignifying Simon. And he's spurring others on, he's spurring us readers on to imitate him. It's interesting how Simon is very specifically identified, isn't it? He's the father of Rufus and Alexander. We don't know who these people are, but probably the early church knew who they were. And by mentioning these people, Mark is sort of performing an act of public recognition. He's saying to his readers, "Oh, by the way, you know Alexander and Rufus? Well, this was their dad who did this. This is their dad who carried Jesus' cross with him along that road. And you can imagine then for Alexander and for Rufus, and indeed for everyone who knew Simon of Cyrene, when they read those words, their hearts must have been stirred with a sense of pride. It must have been stirring to bring that thought back to their mind. Here is a picture of a disciple, one we knew, one we were related to, our dad, literally carrying the cross of Jesus, literally following him in his service, literally imitating his selfless service, sharing in his suffering in his own limited way. And I think that image should affect us as well. It brings to life those commands that Jesus gave us in the previous chapters. You know, whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel will save it. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, but it shall not be so among you. Those commands to be a servant, that they might have seemed quite remote, quite intimidating back then. But at least now we have this great example before us. We have Jesus himself, our ultimate model, the Son of Man who comes not to be served but to serve. And we have along with him this man, Simon of Cyrene, this vivid picture of a disciple carrying his cross with him. And Mark is saying to Alexander and Rufus, you know, on the day when all the world mocked and derided and tormented your Saviour, I want you to know that your dad walked on that road with him and he shouldered his cross. It was all the world against Jesus Christ and your dad on that day. And it should stir Alexander and Rufus, and it should stir everyone who knew Simon, and it should stir us as well. We want to be fellow servants. We want to be cross carriers. We want to be those who spurn the appearance of dignity and worldly approval and brave the mockery and the false accusations and all the pressure and all the sacrifice so that we might be able to serve God and his people. So be challenged by this. Be challenged by this picture of Jesus, the selfless servant. So that's our first point this evening. I'll try to keep my second one a little shorter. Secondly then, Jesus, the self-confident Son of Man. Jesus, the self-confident Son of Man. The final verse of our passage records those words of the scribes. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down from the cross that we may see and believe. And it's actually quite a forceful argument, isn't it? If you are the Christ, if you are the anointed one, if you are the King of Israel, all you have to do to prove yourself is come down from that cross and we will believe. We will admit that we're wrong. We will be converted. We will join your team. On the surface, it's quite a forceful argument. So how does Jesus resist it? How does Jesus resist the urge to save himself? Well, precisely, I think, for this reason. Jesus really does believe that he is the Christ. Jesus really does believe he is the King of Israel. Jesus really does believe he is the Son of Man, God's great chosen King of heaven and earth. And as the Christ, and as the King of Israel, and as the Son of Man, he considers it his duty not to save himself. Now, what do I mean by that? Why is it the duty of Christ, the King, not to save himself? Well, I'll start by saying this. It's interesting to see just how much the gospel writers reference the Psalms in their treatment of the crucifixion. And we see it in Mark chapter 15, especially with regards to Psalm 22. Psalm 22 seems to be referenced an awful lot. You've got the mockery, the wagging of the heads in verse 29. What's Mark doing? He's taking us right back to Psalm 22, verse 7. All who see me mock me, they make mouths at me, they wag their heads. You've got the dividing of the garments in verse 24. Takes us to Psalm 22, verse 18. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. And of course, in the next section, Jesus himself will quote from Psalm 22 the opening words, my God, why have you forsaken me? So the point is that Mark wants us to draw together the experience of the psalmist, especially in 22, and the experience of Jesus. He wants us to see those two things in parallel. Indeed, I think he wants us to see Jesus as the main character of Psalm 22. And I would argue, as well as that, really he wants us to see Jesus as the main character in all of those psalms, which Psalm 22 very wonderfully sort of captures, all of those psalms in which God's anointed one is persecuted by his enemies. And in particular, that's the theme of the first 41 books of the Psalms. That is, book one of the Psalter, book one of the Psalms. That book has this unmissable theme. It's the theme of the Lord's chosen king, the Lord's anointed, the Lord's Messiah being hunted down, being pursued and threatened and falsely accused by his enemies. And here's what I want us to see about that. We ask the question, what is the pattern of those psalms in the first psalm book and those psalms where the king is persecuted? What does the Lord's king, the Lord's Christ, what does he do in those psalms? Well, intriguingly, we never find him plotting against his enemies. We never find him coming up with plans for how to get back at his enemies for what they've done to him. Now, you read through those psalms, and you'll find that virtually all of them end with the psalmist doing the same thing, again and again and again. He's patiently trusting the Lord for his salvation. He's trusting the Lord to deliver his life. He's trusting the Lord to put his enemies to shame. And yes, his soul in those psalms is greatly troubled, and he makes great complaints. He says, "Awake and rouse yourself for my vindication. Vindicate me, O Lord my God, according to your righteousness." Psalm 25. He asks the question, how long is this going to go on? He's often at his wit's end. But in every, or virtually all of those psalms, we find the Lord's anointed trusting the Lord for vindication. Trusting the Lord that he will uphold his righteousness. Trusting that salvation belongs to the Lord. And at times, the psalmist almost concludes with the sense that salvation is just on the horizon. Psalm 17 ends, "As for me, I shall behold your righteousness. When I awake, I shall be satisfied with your likeness." You read that first book of the Psalms and see that theme there for yourself. God's anointed, his king, trusting in the Lord, trusting that he will deliver him from his enemies, expecting that he will. And Psalm 22, which Mark refers to an awful lot in this passage, is particularly irrelevant because it's doing the same thing, and particularly relevant because while Psalm 22 starts out bleak, it starts out with groaning, there is a very clear hinge point in that psalm. That psalm ends very differently to how it begins. It actually ends with a celebration of the longed-for deliverance. Indeed, we might say, like many of those psalms, it ends with the hope of resurrection. "You have rescued me from the horns of the wild oxen," says the psalmist. And to bring it back to this question then, this matter of Jesus in Mark 15, I'm simply saying this is precisely the attitude we're seeing here. These scribes, they might mock, but Jesus really believes that he is the Christ, he really believes that he is the king, he really believes that that sign above his head, the king of the Jews, could not be more true. And if that is true, then he really believes that the Lord is on his side and he will uphold his chosen king in the face of his enemies. And so why is Jesus not saving himself? Why is he not buying into their argument that if he does, they'll believe in him? Why is he not climbing down from the cross and calling fire upon his enemies? Well, this is why, because like David and like the anointed in those psalms, He is holding out absolute faith in God, and he's trusting that he really is the man in Psalm 22, that he really is the Christ, the King of Israel, and for that very reason he is believing that if only he holds through to the very end, God will vindicate him. He believes the words of Psalm 16, that God will not abandon his soul to Sheol or allow his Holy One to see corruption. He believes with Psalm 40, that if only he waits patiently for the Lord, he will hear his cry, he will draw him up from the pit of destruction. And simply then I'm saying this, that on the cross, Jesus remains that self-confident Son of Man. That is who I am, he's saying to himself. God will save me. I will do what he's commanded me to do. I will lay down my life. I will go through all of this. And I do not need to lash out at those persecutors, because I know that God will vindicate his chosen servant in the end. There's even a sense, isn't there, in which the mockery against Jesus on the cross points him back to that hope. In verse 29, the mockers cry out, "You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days." And we often look at that verse and think, oh, well, they've clearly misunderstood what Jesus was saying there. But in actual fact, I think they are remembering to some accuracy the things that Jesus prophesied in Jerusalem in the days leading up to his death. Jesus had prophesied judgment against Jerusalem, judgment upon the temple, the prospect of a new temple in its place, the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven, and the prospect that something very big was going to happen in just 3 days. Jesus had prophesied all of that, and to what extent these things have got muddled in their minds, I don't know, but the reality is that there is a truth behind that mockery that they scarcely realise. In 3 days' time, something big is going to happen. A new temple is going to replace the old. And very soon, the Son of Man is going to step out of his grave, vindicated and glorious, and he's going to ascend into heaven. He's going to take his throne, and he's going to usher in an exciting new phase in the history of the world. And so Jesus hears that mockery. And perhaps just part of him, is able to latch on to that hope. Just 3 days. 3 days. 3 days. At least they're right about that. 3 days. Not long. 3 days. I'm coming to a close now, but as we finish, I just want us to see this theme once again, but I want us to go back to that detail of the wine. The wine and the myrrh. Jesus refuses to drink it. And we said that the reason he refused to drink it is he doesn't want to numb the pain. He wants it to be a meaningful, painful sacrifice. But I think probably there's another reason why he refuses to drink it as well. And it's this. Remember what Jesus had said to his disciples back in chapter 14. He was eating the Passover with his disciples. And in chapter 14, verse 25, as he drinks the wine at the Passover, at the Last Supper, he says to them, "Truly I say to you, I will not drink again of the fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." And I think that comment in Mark 14 puts a new light on what's happening here in our passage. You know, if Jesus really thought that his death was the end, he could have very easily thought to himself, well, why not? I mean, it's not as if I'm going to be able to taste anything ever again. I might as well just take the opportunity as it comes. I might as well just enjoy one final taste of wine and die. But you see, by refusing to drink the wine on the cross, he's once again showing that great self-confidence. He's saying, no, I am king. And as king, I don't need your narcotic, I don't need your wine, because I am looking forward to a better wine. I am looking forward to the new wine of the kingdom. And the very next drop which touches my lips will be that wine. And I have every confidence that before long my cup will be full of it. I've said before that there's a joy which gets Jesus through the cross. for the joy that is set before him, Jesus endures the cross, as we read from Hebrews. And while every nerve in his body is screaming in pain and he's being bombarded with mockery, and while every breath he takes hurts more and more, I think something deep in his mind has latched on to that future hope. And perhaps even we could say this, though it's a bit fanciful, perhaps we could say that as he looks around at the surrounding scenery, the mountains of Israel, and the morning sun is still warm upon the hills, who's to say he doesn't remember a verse like Amos chapter 9 verse 13? The mountains shall drip sweet wine, and all the hills shall flow with it. And right now you see it's promises like that which are sustaining Jesus and holding him to the course and keeping his eyes on the goal. New wine is coming, and soon the mountains will fill with it. And tonight then, I want you to put your confidence in his confidence. This is the self-confident Son of Man. All of us here tonight are approaching the grave. It might not be crucifixion, but it won't be pretty. It will be nasty, and it will threaten to take everything away from us and throw us into the darkness. And how do you face a thing like that? How do you face something as ugly as death? Well, you face it in the knowledge that you are united to Jesus Christ. And what is his lot is your lot. And if he can face death clinging to the hope of resurrection for God's chosen one, so can you. You can die, not in your own confidence, but in his confidence that this truly is the Son of Man, and he is, in 3 days' time, going to rise from the grave, and with him, you will as well. And so I end by saying, if you don't trust Jesus yet this evening, trust him now. Do not simply be compelled by his character, be converted by it. And let him serve you, and let him rescue you from your greatest problem. Let him rescue you from your death. And trust him as the Son of Man, who doesn't just die a meaningless death on that cross, but dies as God's King, who in 3 days' time is going to be vindicated and raised from the grave. Amen.